23. August 4th, continued. It was the next morning he shot me. I woke at dawn as usual, moved my blanket and sleeping bag to the cave, and ate the rest of the fish for breakfast. Cold, but cooked, not so bad. As I ate, I cheered up a little and thought possibly, just possibly, I'd been too pessimistic about the padlocks. I knew that he had a compulsion for taking charge of things, for saving things, for rationing them out in an orderly manner so they would last, like the V-belt, the gasoline, the fertilizer, and so on. A long-term view. And he did not trust me to do that, perhaps rightly. Hence the locks. Maybe that was all it meant. In any case, I had to find out, fearful as I was of the answer. Because the other alternative was that he had thought of a simple way to force me to come back. Starvation. I could not help considering that, too. If it was his plan, what would I do? I had food enough in the cave for a couple of weeks, maybe longer if I did not eat much. I could fish. I knew where berries grew. I could possibly shoot a rabbit. But it was obvious that in the long run I could not live. And what about the chickens, the eggs, the milk, the garden? Would he somehow lock them up, too? There was little point in wondering. I had to find out. So, feeling worried and quite depressed, I took my milk can and my sack and walked to the house, going the long way around. It seemed especially important now to keep him from finding where I stayed. As I walked, I had another thought. Perhaps, in a way, these new things he had done were my own fault. It seemed that the more I stayed away from him, the more determined he was that I come back. Perhaps I could yield a little. There are people who cannot stand being alone. Perhaps he was acting from despair. Why should I not, then, offer to talk to him if he wanted me to, say for an hour or so in the evenings, he on the porch, I on the road? It could do no harm. There was no reason I should not be as friendly as safety permitted. It was a sensible plan, and made me feel better. When I came in sight of the house, I decided not to go about my work as usual, but to let him know straight away that I had seen the padlocks and asked for the key. I had to get it settled. It was, in fact, time to bring him some more stores anyway, and at the same time I could suggest my new idea. I know now that he was watching as I came up the road and was expecting me to come to the house. Not that it made any great difference in his plans when I came. I would have had to ask eventually. I remember now that my father once said that great events have a way of happening uneventfully. They slip up on you and are over before you know they have happened. This could hardly be called a great event, I suppose, but it was for me an important and terrible one, and it happened almost without my knowing it. I stood there in front of the house, as I had before, watching the front door, thinking I would go and knock if he did not appear. There was a sharp snapping noise. I was wondering what and where it could be, when I felt a hard tug on the leg of my blue jeans and a sting of pain in my right ankle. The noise came again. Not until then did I look up and see the shiny blue rifle barrel, very thin, the upstairs window 6 inches open and his face behind it, partially hidden by the curtain. The second shot missed, hit the blacktop a foot behind me, and flew away humming like a bee. I dropped my milk can and ran for my life. The can hit the road with a clang and rolled away. Pharaoh, in the house, hearing the shots and the clanging, barked in a frenzy. I dashed for the trees beside Burden Creek, expecting each second another bullet to come crashing into me, because for the next 30 yards my back was still a clear target. But he fired no more. Even thought I heard the window shut, but did not pause to look. In the trees I felt reasonably safe. I made my way, dodging from tree to tree on the far side of the road. At the bend, where I could look back and see that he was not following, I sat down to examine my ankle. The bullet had gone through the leg of my blue jeans, leaving 2 small round holes, and the sock underneath showed a narrow, straight tear through which blood was slowly oozing. I removed my sneaker and sock. Below was a small, shallow cut, barely through the skin, bordered on both sides by a white area, very sore to touch, which was going to be a bruise and turn black and blue. As wounds go, it was not serious. In fact, while I sat there looking, the bleeding virtually stopped. Still, it brought to mind a lack in my supplies. I had no bandage, no disinfectant of any kind. There was some in the house, some in the store, both now out of reach. Then I remembered. I did have soap at the cave. I could wash the cut, at least, and put on a clean sock. I tied my shoe on loosely and walked on. As I washed my ankle, I thought it was a most peculiar wound and puzzling. He had fired 2 shots. If he was trying to hit me, both had been aimed much too low. He might just be a very bad shot, but that hardly seemed likely. Not with me standing stock still, for the first shot at least, and him in a prepared position, waiting, with the windowsill for support. Nobody could be that bad a shot. Was he trying to miss, trying to scare me away? Maybe. And yet in a way that made him even a worse shot. Anyone shooting can miss when trying to hit something, but to hit when trying to miss it. And then, sickeningly, the truth came to me. The idea, the scene, the things that happened in the next minutes, the next hour, were so bad that I do not like to think about them. Each time they come back to me, they are like a nightmare, and I am living them over again. I'm sitting beside the pond with my sock in my hand and my shoe beside me, waiting for my foot to dry. The piece of soap was on a stone at the edge of the water, and I suddenly realized that he was not trying to miss. He wanted to shoot me in the leg so I could not walk. He wanted to maim, not to kill me, so that he could catch me. It was a simple plan, a terrible one. Starvation would force me to come to the house or the store, and the gun would keep me from going away again. And I knew he would try until he succeeded. Why? That was all I could ask. As I sat there by the pond, I heard the tractor start. I knew by some instinct before I saw it what was going to happen next. So I put on my sock and my shoe as fast as I could and ran up the hill to the bushes where I had hid before. The tractor, looking bright red in the morning sun, came out of the trees. On it, as before, holding his gun in his hand, rode Mr. Loomis. The gun barrel shone like a tube of blue glass. It was the small rifle, the .22. He did not want to shatter my leg, only cripple it, because after I was caught, he intended it to mend again. The tractor came out, and behind it was hitched the tractor cart. In the tractor cart, tied by his leash, sat Pharaoh. He was enjoying the ride. He had always liked to ride in the cart. Mr. Loomis stopped at the store as before, climbed down, gun ready. That time he knew I was not inside, but he also knew I had more reason to shoot if I was hiding nearby. So he looked about him sharply. Then he took Pharaoh down from the cart and began the game they had practiced. Holding the leash, he circled the store. Pharaoh picked up my trail immediately, the freshest one, leading toward the house. Mr. Loomis did not want that one. He tried again, a wider circle, and that time it worked. Pharaoh started retracing my morning's route, tail wagging, backtracking easily, and suddenly that small, friendly dog, David's dog, was an enemy, as dangerous as a tiger, because I knew what he was going to do. He would lead Mr. Loomis a mile down the road. He would turn left and lead him up the hill and to the cave. The nightmare lasted an hour. That is how long it took Mr. Loomis, who did not hurry, but did not limp either, to make the trip. Long before that, I had run to the cave. My time there was up. I knew it was. I had my cloth sack, the feed bag I had brought from the barn, and I threw into it what I could carry, not choosing very well because I was stupidly crying and because my ankle was hurting badly. I took cans of food, this notebook, a blanket, my knife, some water. That was all I could manage, that and a gun. I took the small rifle, the pump-action .22, and put a box of shells in my pocket. I had no place to go except higher up the hill and into the woods. I chose a spot overlooking the way they had to pass as they approached the cave. There, waiting, ready to run again, I had the worst part of my nightmare, because I suddenly saw what I must do. Wherever I ran, as long as Mr. Loomis had Pharaoh, he would find me. I knew that, therefore, I had to shoot Pharaoh. I loaded the gun, found a hummock for a gun rest, and lay behind it. 15 minutes later, I saw branches moving. They were still a quarter mile down the valley, still on my trail. My ankle ached worse than before, but the crying had stopped. I felt sick to my stomach, but my eyes were clear. At last, they were directly below me. Mr. Loomis was going very slowly and limping a little. Pharaoh was tugging at his short leash. In clear view, Mr. Loomis stopped to listen, and I had a stationary target. I drew the bead, the gun was steady, and I could not miss. But at that moment, Pharaoh gave a small, impatient tug and a small bark, which came clearly up the hill to my ears. It was his bark of greeting, a soft pleasure bark for me. He knew the cave was just ahead. And at the sound, so gentle and familiar, my finger went limp on the trigger, and I could not do it. In the end, I lowered the gun barrel, and they moved on out of sight. In a few more minutes, they were at the cave. I could not see them from where I was hidden, and I did not dare go closer because I knew he would be watching. I smelled smoke, retreated farther up the hill, and looked back. From the direction of the cave, I saw it, a thick column rising fast as if it came from a bonfire. Feeling sicker, quite dizzy, in fact, I sat down and loosened my shoe. For half an hour, the smoke continued. Toward the end, it grew thinner and finally faded away. Then, in the distance, I heard the sound of the tractor engine. It grew fainter as it moved toward the house. Mr. Lewis had walked enough for the day and was going home. When the sound had stopped, I knew it was safe, and I made my way, sparing my right foot, back to the cave. It was hard to keep from crying again. In front of the entrance, in a black and smoldering pile, were the remains of all my things. My sleeping bag, my clothes, even the box I used as a table, and the board I had for a bench, all were cinders. My firewall had been kicked down and scattered, my water bottles smashed. I saw in the heap a part of the charred cover of famous short stories of England and America. The few cans of food I had left he had taken away. At least I saw no signs of them in the fire. And the other gun was gone. Inside the cave, I found one thing he missed. My half-chicken was still in its cranny. That was, and is, my nightmare. The worst part of it was that I really did decide to kill Pharaoh. I am glad I could not pull the trigger, but that does not alter the fact. It makes me feel as much a murderer as Mr. Loomis. Now there are two of us in the valley. And in the end, I did kill Pharaoh, though not with the gun.